I offered my hand, and Deke took hold. She liked you, although she never could figure out what to make of you. She said you reminded her of the way they used to show ghosts in those old movies from the 30s. He's bright and shiny, but not all here, she said. I'm no ghost, I said, I promise you. He smiled. No. I finally got around to checking your references. This was after you'd been subbing for us a while and did such a bang-up job with the play. The ones from the Sarasota School District are fine, but beyond there... He shook his head, still smiling. And your degree is from a mill in Oklahoma. Clearing my throat did no good. I couldn't speak at all. And what's that to me, you ask? Not much. There was a time in this part of the world when if a man rode into town with a few books in his saddlebag, spectacles on his nose, and a tie around his neck, he could get hired on as a schoolmaster and stay for 20 years. Wasn't that long ago, either. You're a damn fine teacher. The kids know it, I know it, and Memes knew it, too. And that's a lot to me. Does Ellen know I faked my other references? Because Ellen Dougherty was acting principal, and once the school board met in January, the job would be hers permanently. There were no other candidates. Nope, but she's not going to. Not for me, at least. I feel like she doesn't need to. He stood up. But there's one person who does need to know the truth about where you've been and what you've done. And that's a certain lady librarian. If you're serious about her, that is. Are you? Yes, I said, and Deke nodded as if that took care of everything. I only wished it did. Thanks to Deke Simmons, Sadie finally got to find out what it was like to make love after sundown. When I asked her how it was, she told me it had been wonderful. But I'm looking forward to waking up next to you in the morning even more. Do you hear the wind? I did. It hooted around the eaves. Doesn't that sound make you feel cozy? Yes. I'm going to say something now. I hope it doesn't make you uncomfortable. Tell me. I guess I've fallen in love with you. Maybe it's just the sex. I've heard that's a mistake people make, but I don't think so. Sadie? Yes. She was trying to smile, but she looked frightened. I love you, too. No maybe or mistake about it. Thank God, she said and snuggled close. On our second visit to the Candlewood bungalow, she was ready to talk about Johnny Clayton. But turn out the light, would you? I did as she asked. She smoked 3 cigarettes during the telling. Toward the end, she cried hard, probably not from remembered pain so much as simple embarrassment. For most of us, I think it's easier to admit doing wrong than being stupid. Not that she had been. There's a world of difference between stupidity and naivete. And like most good middle-class girls who came to maturity in the 1940s and 50s, Sadie knew almost nothing about sex. She said she'd never actually looked at a penis until she'd looked at mine. She'd had glimpses of Johnny's, but she said if he caught her looking, he would take hold of her face and turn it away with a grip that stopped just short of painful. But it always did hurt, she said. You know, John Clayton came from a conventionally religious family. Nothing nutty about them. He was pleasant, attentive, reasonably attractive. He didn't have the world's greatest sense of humor. Almost none might have been closer to the mark. But he seemed to adore her. Her parents adored him. Claire Dunhill was especially crazy about Johnny Clayton. And of course, he was taller than Sadie, even when she was in heels. After years of beanpole jokes, that was important. The only troubling thing about the marriage was his compulsive neatness, Sadie said. He had all his books alphabetized, and he got very upset if you moved them around. He was nervous if you took even one off the shelf. You could feel it, a kind of tensing. He shaved 3 times a day and washed his hands all the time. If someone shook with him, he'd make an excuse to rush off to the lab and wash just as soon as he could. "Also color-coordinated clothes," I said, "on his body and in the closet, and woe to the person who moved them around. Did he alphabetize the stuff in the pantry, or get up sometimes in the night to check that the stove burners were off and the doors were locked?" She turned to me, her eyes wide and wondering in the dark. The bed squeaked companionably. The wind gusted. A loose windowpane rattled.
"How do you know that?"
"It's a syndrome, obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD for short. Howard..." I stopped. "Howard Hughes has a bad case of it," I'd started to say. But maybe that wasn't true yet. Even if it was, people probably didn't know. An old friend of mine had it, Howard Temple. Never mind.
Did he hurt you, Sadie?"
Not really. No beating or punching. He slapped me once, that's all. But people hurt people in other ways, don't they?"
"Yes."
"I couldn't talk to anyone about it, certainly not my mother. Do you know what she told me on my wedding day? That if I said half a prayer before and half a prayer during, everything would be fine. During was as close as she could come to the word intercourse. I tried to talk to my friend Ruthie about it, but only once. This was after school, and she was helping me pick up the library. 'What goes on behind the bedroom door is none of my business,' she said." I stopped, because I didn't really want to talk about it. I was so ashamed. Then it came in a rush. Some of what she said was blurred by tears, but I got the gist. On certain nights, maybe once a week, maybe twice, he would tell her he needed to get it out. They would be lying side by side in bed, she in her nightgown. He insisted she wear ones that were opaque. He in a pair of boxer shorts. Boxers were the closest she ever came to seeing him naked. He would push the sheet down to his waist, and she would see his erection tenting them. Once he looked at that little tent himself, only once that I remember. And you know what he said?
"No."
"How disgusting we are." Then he said, "Get it over with so I can get some sleep." She would reach beneath the sheet and masturbate him. It never took long, sometimes only seconds. On a few occasions he touched her breasts as she performed this function, but mostly his hands remained knotted high on his chest. When it was over, he would go into the bathroom, wash himself off, and come back in wearing his pajamas. He had 7 pairs, all blue. Then it was her turn to go into the bathroom and wash her hands. He insisted that she do this for at least 3 minutes, and under water hot enough to turn her skin red. When she came back to bed, she held her palms out to his face. If the smell of Lifebuoy wasn't strong enough to satisfy him, she would have to do it again. And when I came back, the broom would be there. He would put it on top of the sheet if it was summer, on the blankets if it was winter, running straight down the middle of the bed, his side and her side. If I was restless and happened to move it, he'd wake up. No matter how fast asleep he was, he'd push me back to my side, hard. He called it transgressing the broom. The time he slapped her was when she asked how they would ever have children if he never put it in her. He was furious. That's why he slapped me. He apologized later, but what he said right then was, "Do you think I'd put myself in your germy woman hole and bring children into this filthy world? It's all going to blow up anyway. Anyone who reads the paper can see that coming. And the radiation will kill us. We'll die with sores all over our bodies and coughing up our lungs. It could happen any day."
"Jesus, no wonder you left him, Sadie."
Only after 4 wasted years, it took me that long to convince myself that I deserved more from life than color-coordinating my husband's sock drawer, giving him hand jobs twice a week, and sleeping with a goddamn broom. That was the most humiliating part, the part I was sure I could never talk about to anyone, because it was funny. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was somewhere in the twilight zone between neurosis and outright psychosis. I also thought I was listening to the perfect 50s fable. It was easy to imagine Rock Hudson and Doris Day sleeping with a broom between them. If Rock hadn't been gay, that was. And he hasn't come looking for you. No. I applied to a dozen different schools and had the answers sent to a post office box. I felt like a woman having an affair, sneaking around, and that's how my mother and father treated me when they found out. My dad has come around a little. I think he suspects how bad it was, although, of course, he doesn't want to know any of the details. But my mother, not her, she's furious with me. She had to change churches and quit the sewing bee because she couldn't hold her head up, she says. In a way, this seemed as cruel and crazy as the broom, but I didn't say so. A different aspect of the matter interested me more than Sadie's conventional Southern parents. Clayton didn't tell them you were gone? Have I got that right? Never came to see them? No. My mother understood, of course. Sadie's ordinarily faint Southern accent deepened. I just shamed that poor boy so bad that he didn't want to tell anyone. She dropped the drawl. I'm not being sarcastic either. She understands shame, and she understands covering up. On those two things, Johnny and my mama are in perfect harmony. She's the one he should have married. She laughed a little hysterically. Mama probably would have loved that old broom. Never a word from him? Not even a postcard saying, "Hey, Sadie, let's tie up the loose ends so we can get on with our lives." How could there be? He doesn't know where I am, and I'm sure he doesn't care. Is there anything you want from him? Because I'm sure a lawyer... She kissed me. The only thing I want is here, in bed, with me. I kicked the sheets down to her ankles. Look at me, Sadie. No charge. She looked, and then she touched. I drowsed afterward, not deep. I could still hear the wind and that one rattling window pane, but I got far enough down to dream. Sadie and I were in an empty house. We were naked. Something was moving around upstairs. It made thudding, unpleasant noises. It might have been pacing, but it seemed as if there were too many feet. I didn't feel guilty that we were going to be discovered with our clothes off. I felt scared. Written in charcoal on the peeling plaster of one wall were the words, "I will kill the president soon." Below it, someone had added, "Not soon enough, he's full of disease." This had been printed in dark lipstick, or maybe it was blood. Thud, clump, thud, from overhead. "I think it's Frank Dunning," I whispered to Sadie. I gripped her arm. It was very cold. It was like gripping the arm of a dead person. A woman who'd been beaten to death with a sledgehammer, perhaps. Sadie shook her head. She was looking up at the ceiling, her mouth trembling. Clud, thump, clud, plaster dust sifting down. "Then it's John Clayton," I whispered. "No," she said, "I think it's the yellow card man. He prepped the gymla." Above us, the thudding stopped abruptly. She took hold of my arm and began to shake it. Her eyes were eating up her face. "It is. It's the gymla. And it hurt us. The gymla knows we're here." "Wake up, George. Wake up." I opened my eyes. She was propped on one elbow beside me, her face a pale blur. What time is it? Do we have to go?" But it was still dark, and the wind was still high. "No, it isn't even midnight. You were having a bad dream." She laughed a little nervously. "Maybe about football? Because you were saying gymla, gymla." "Was I?" I sat up. There was the scrape of a match, and her face was momentarily illuminated as she lit a cigarette. "Yes, you were. You said all kinds of stuff." That was not good. "Like what?" Most of it I couldn't make out, but one thing was pretty clear. Dairy is Dallas, you said. Then you said it backwards. Dallas is Dairy. What was that about? Do you remember?
No.
But it's hard to lie convincingly when you're fresh out of sleep, even a shallow doze, and I saw skepticism on her face. Before it could deepen into disbelief, there was a knock at the door. A quarter to midnight? A knock? We stared at each other. The knock came again.
It's the Jimla.
This thought was very clear, very certain. Sadie put her cigarette in the ashtray, gathered the sheet around her, and ran to the bathroom without a word. The door shut behind her.
"Who is it?"
I asked.
"It's Mr. Yorty, sir. Bud Yorty."
One of the gay retired teachers who ran the place. I got out of bed and pulled on my pants.
"What is it, Mr. Yorty?"
"I have a message for you, sir. Lady said it was urgent."
I opened the door. He was a small man in a threadbare bathrobe. His hair was a sleep-frizzed cloud around his head. In one hand he held a piece of paper.
"What lady?"
"Ellen Dougherty?"
I thanked him for his trouble and closed the door. I unfolded the paper and read the message. Sadie came out of the bathroom, still clutching the sheet. Her eyes were wide and frightened.
"What is it?"
"There's been an accident," I said. "Vince Knowles rolled his pickup truck outside of town. Mike Coslaw and Bobby Jill were with him. Mike was thrown clear. He has a broken arm. Bobby Jill has a nasty cut on her face, but Ellie says she's okay otherwise."
"Vince?"
I thought of the way everyone said Vince drove, as if there were no tomorrow. Now there wasn't, not for him. "He's dead, Sadie." Her mouth dropped open.
"He can't be. He's only 18 years old."
"I know." The sheet fell free of her relaxing arms and puddled around her feet. She put her hands over her face. My revised version of 12 Angry Men was canceled. What took its place was Death of a Student, a play in three acts, the viewing at the funeral parlor, the service at Grace Methodist Church, the graveside service at West Hill Cemetery. This mournful show was attended by the whole town, or near enough to make no difference. The parents and Vince's stunned kid's sister starred at the viewing, sitting in folding chairs beside the coffin. When I approached them with Sadie at my side, Mrs. Knowles rose and put her arms around me. I was almost overwhelmed by the odors of White Shoulders perfume and Eudora antiperspirant.
"You changed his life," she whispered in my ear. "He told me so. For the first time he made his grades because he wanted to act."
"Mrs. Knowles, I'm so, so sorry," I said. Then a terrible thought crossed my mind, and I hugged her tighter as if hugging could make it go away. Maybe it's the butterfly effect. Maybe Vince is dead because I came to Jody. The coffin was flanked by photomontages of Vince's too brief life. On an easel in front of it all by itself was a picture of him in his Of Mice and Men costume and that battered old felt hat from Props. His ratty, intelligent face peered out from beneath. Vince really hadn't been much of an actor, but that photo caught him wearing an absolute, perfect, wise-ass smile. Sadie began to sob, and I knew why. Life turns on a dime. Sometimes toward us, but more often it spins away, flirting and flashing as it goes. "So long, honey." It was good while it lasted, wasn't it? And Jody was good. Good for me. In Dairy, I was an outsider, but Jody was home. Here's home. The smell of the sage, and the way the hills flush orange with Indian blanket in the summer. The faint taste of tobacco on Sadie's tongue, and the squeak of the oiled wood floorboards in my homeroom. Ellie Dougherty caring enough to send us a message in the middle of the night, perhaps so we could get back to town undiscovered, but probably just so we'd know. The nearly suffocating mixture of perfume and deodorant as Mrs. Knowles hugged me. Mike putting his arm
the one not buried in a cast, around me at the cemetery, then pressing his face against my shoulder until he could get himself under control again. The ugly red slash on Bobby Jill's face is home, too. And thinking that unless she had plastic surgery, which her family could not afford, it would leave a scar that would remind her for the rest of her life of how she'd seen a boy from just down the road dead at the side of the road, his head mostly torn off his shoulders. Home is the black armband that Sadie wore, that I wore, that the whole faculty wore for a week after, and Al Stevens posting Vince's photo in the window of his diner, and Jimmy Ledoux's tears as he stood up in front of the whole school and dedicated the undefeated season to Vince Knowles. Other things, too. People saying howdy on the street. People giving me a wave from their cars. Al Stevens taking Sadie and me to the table at the back that he had started calling our table. Playing cribbage on Friday afternoons in the teacher's room with Danny Laverty for a penny a point. Arguing with elderly Miss Mayer about who gave the better newscast, Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, or Walter Cronkite. My street. My shotgun house. Getting used to using a typewriter again. Having a best girl and getting S&H green stamps with my groceries and real butter on my movie popcorn. Home is watching the moon rise over the open, sleeping land and having someone you can call to the window so you can look together. Home is where you dance with others. And dancing is life. The year of our Lord 1961 was winding down. On a drizzly day about 2 weeks before Christmas, I came into my house after school, once more bundled into my rawhide ranch coat, and heard the phone ringing.
"This is Ivy Templeton," a woman said. "You probably don't even remember me, do you?"
"I remember you very well, Miss Templeton."
"I don't know why I even bothered to call. That goddamn $10 is long since spent. Just something about you stuck in my head. Rosette, too, she calls you the man who cotched my ball."
"You're moving out, Miss Templeton?"
"That's 100% goddamn right. My mama's coming up from Moselle tomorrow in the truck."
"Don't you have a car, or did it break down?"
"Car's running okay for a junker, but Harry ain't gonna be riding in it or driving it ever again. He was working one of those goddamn manpower jobs last month. Fell in a ditch, and a gravel truck run over him while it was backing up. Broke his spine."
Closed my eyes and saw the smashed remains of Vince's truck being hauled down Main Street behind the wrecker from Goji's Sunoco, blood all over the inside of the cracked windshield. "I'm sorry to hear that, Miss Templeton."
"He gonna live, but he ain't never gonna walk again. He gonna sit in a wheelchair and pee in a bag. That's what he gonna do. But first, he's gonna ride down Moselle in the back of my mama's truck. We'll steal the mattress out in the bedroom for him to lay on. Be like taking your dog on vacation, won't it?"
She started to cry. "I'm running out on 2 months back rent, but that don't confront me none. You know what does confront me, Mr. Puddin'-Tane? Ask me again, and I'll tell you the same. I got 35 goddamn dollars, and that's the end of it. Goddamn asshole Harry, if he could have kept his feet, I wouldn't be in this fix. I thought I was in one before, but now look at this." There was a long, watery snork in my ear.
"Know what? The mailman been giving me the glad eye, and I think for $20 I'd roll him a fuck on the goddamn living room floor. If the goddamn neighbors across the street couldn't watch us while we was going at it. Can't very well take him in the bedroom, can I? That's where my broke-back husband is."
She rasped out a laugh.
"Tell you what, why don't you come on over in your fancy convertible? Take me to a motel somewhere, spend a little extra, get one with a settin' room. Rosette can watch TV and I'll roll you a fuck. You look like you's doing okay."
I said nothing. I just had an idea that was as bright as a flashbulb.
"If the goddamn neighbors across the street couldn't watch us going at it..."
There was a man I was supposed to be watching for, besides Oswald himself, that was. A man whose name also happened to be George, and who was going to become Oswald's only friend.
"Don't trust him,"
Al had written in his notes.
"Are you there, Mr. Pudentane? No? If not, fuck you and good b—"
"Don't hang up, Miss Templeton. Suppose I were to pay your back rent and throw in $100 on top of that." It was far more than I needed to pay for what I wanted, but I had it and she needed it. "Right now I'd do you with my father watching for $200. "You don't have to do me at all, Miss Templeton. All you have to do is meet me in that parking lot at the end of the street and bring me something." It was dark by the time I got to the parking lot of the Montgomery Ward warehouse, and the rain had started to thicken a little, the way it does when it's trying to be sleet. That doesn't happen often in the hill country south of Dallas, but sometimes isn't never. I hoped I could make it back to Jody without sliding off the road. Ivy was sitting behind the wheel of a sad old sedan with rusty rocker panels and a cracked rear window. She got into my Ford and immediately leaned toward the heater vent, which was going full blast. She was wearing two flannel shirts instead of a coat and shivering.
"Feels good. That Chev's colder'n a witch's tit. Heater's bust. You bring the money, Mr. Pudentane?"
I gave her an envelope. She opened it and riffled through some of the 20s that had been sitting on the top shelf of my closet ever since I'd collected on my World Series bet at Faith Financial over a year before. She lifted her substantial bottom off the seat, shoved the envelope into the back pocket of her jeans, then fumbled in the breast pocket of the shirt closer to her body. She brought out a key and slapped it into my hand.
"That do you?"
It did me very well. "It's a dupe, right?"
"Just like you told me. I had it made at the hardware store on McLaren Street. Why you want a key to that glorified shithouse? For $200 you could rent it for 4 months."
"I've got my reasons. Tell me about the neighbors across the street, the ones that could watch you and the mailman doing it on the living room floor." She shifted uneasily and pulled her shirts a little closer across her equally substantial bosom.
"I was just joking about that."
"I know." I didn't, and I didn't care. "I just want to know if the neighbors can really see into your living room."
"Course they can, and I could see into theirs if they didn't have curtains, which I would have bought for our place could I afford 'em. When it comes to privacy, we all might as well be living outside. I suppose I could have put up burlap, scavenged it from right over there."
She pointed to the trash bins lined up against the east side of the warehouse.
"But it looks so slutty."
"The neighbors with the view live at what, 2704?
2706. It used to be Slider Burnett and his family, but they moved out just after Halloween. He was a substitute rodeo clown, do you believe it? Who knew there was such a job? Now it's some fellow named Hazard and his two kids, and I think his mother. Rosette won't play with the kids, says they're dirty, which is a news flash coming from that little pig pan. Old Grammy tries to talk, and it comes out all mush. Side of her face won't move. Don't know what help she can be to him, dragging around like she does. If I get like that, just shoot me. Yee, doggies!"
She shook her head.
"Tell you one thing. They won't be there long. No one stays on Sadie Street."
"Got a cigarette?" I had to give him up.
"When you can't afford a quarter for fags, that's when you know for sure you're on your goddamn uppers."
"I don't smoke." She shrugged.
"What the hell? I can afford my own now, can't I? I'm goddamn rich."
"You ain't married, are you?"
"No."
"Got a girlfriend, though. I can smell perfume on this side of the car. The nice stuff."
That made me smile. "Yes, I've got a girlfriend."
"Good for you. Does she know you're sneaking around the south side of Fort Worth after dark doing funny business?"
I said nothing, but sometimes that's answer enough.
"Never mind. That's between you and her. I'm warm now, so I'll go on back. If it's still rainy and cold like this tomorrow, I don't know what we're going to do about Harry in the back of my ma's truck.
She looked at me, smiling. When I was a kid, I used to think I was going to grow up to be Kim Novak. Now, Rosette, she thinks she's going to replace Darlene on The Mouseketeers. Howdy fucking ho.
She started to open the door, and I said, wait. I raked the crap out of my pockets, lifesavers, Kleenex, book of matches Sadie had tucked in there, notes for a freshman English test I meant to give before the Christmas break, and then gave her the ranch coat. Take this.
I ain't taking your goddamn coat.
She looked shocked. I've got another one at home. I didn't, but I could buy one, and that was more than she could do.
What am I going to tell Harry? That I found it under a goddamn cabbage leaf?
I grinned.
Tell him you rolled the mailman a fuck and bought it with the proceeds. What's he going to do, chase you down the driveway and beat you up?
She laughed a harsh rainbird caw that was strangely charming and took the coat. Regards to Rosette, I said. Tell her I'll see her in her dreams. She stopped smiling.
I hope not, mister.
That one she had about you was a nightmare.
About screamed the house down, she did. Woke me out of a dead sleep at 2 in the morning. She said the man who cotched her ball had a monster in the back seat of his car, and she was afraid it would eat her up. Scared the life out of me, she did, screaming like that.
Did the monster have a name?
Of course it did. She said it was a Jimla? Probably meant a genie, like in those stories about Aladdin and the 7 veils. Anyway, I gotta go. You take care of yourself.
You too, Ivy. Merry Christmas.
She cawed her rainbird laugh again.
Almost forgot about that.
You have one, too. Don't forget to give your girl a present.
She trotted to her old car with my coat, her coat now, thrown over her shoulders. I never saw her again. The rain only froze on the bridges, and I knew from my other life, the one in New England, to be careful on those. But it was still a long drive back to Jody. I had no more than put the water on for a cup of tea when the phone rang. This time it was Sadie. I've been trying to get you since supper time to ask you about Coach Borman's Christmas Eve bash. It starts at 3. I'll go if you want to take me, because then we can get away early. Say we've got dinner reservations at the Saddle or something. I need to RSVP, though. I saw my own invitation lying next to my typewriter and felt a little twinge of guilt. It had been there for 3 days, and I hadn't even opened it.
"Do you want to go?" I asked.
"I wouldn't mind making an appearance."
There was a pause.
"Where have you been all this time?"
"Fort Worth." I almost added Christmas shopping, but I didn't. The only thing I'd bought in Fort Worth was some information and a house key.
"Were you shopping?"
Again, I had to fight not to lie.
Sadie, I really can't say.
There was a long, long pause. I found myself wishing I smoked. Probably I'd developed a contact addiction. God knew I was smoking by proxy all day, every day. The teacher's room was a constant blue haze.
"Is it a woman, George? Another woman, or am I being nosy?"
Well, there was Ivy, but that wasn't the kind of woman she was talking about.
"In the woman department, there's only you."
Another of those long, long pauses. In the world, Sadie could move carelessly. In her head, she never did. At last she said,
"You know a lot about me, things I never thought I could tell anyone, but I know almost nothing about you."
"I guess I just realized that. Sadie can be stupid, George, can't she?"
"You're not stupid, and one thing you do know is that I love you."
"Yes," she sounded doubtful. I remembered the bad dream I'd had that night at the Candlewood bungalows and the caution I'd seen in her face when I told her I didn't remember it. Was that the same look on her face now, or perhaps an expression a little deeper than mere caution?
"Sadie, are we all right?"
"Yes," sounding a little more sure now. Sure we are. Except for Coach's party, what do you want to do about it? Remember that the whole darn school department will be there, and most of them will be drunk on their fannies by the time Mrs. Coach puts on the buffet.
Let's go, I said, too heartily. Party down and kick out the jams.
Kick out the what?
Have some fun. That's all I meant. We'll pop in for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, then pop back out. Dinner at the Saddle. That work for you?
Fine. We were like a couple negotiating for a second date after the first one had been inconclusive.
We'll enjoy ourselves.
I thought about Ivy Templeton smelling the ghost of Sadie's perfume and asking if my girl knew I was sneaking around South Fort Worth after dark doing funny business. I thought about Deke Simmons saying there was one person who deserved to know the truth about where I'd been and what I'd done. But was I going to tell Sadie I'd killed Frank Dunning in cold blood so he wouldn't murder his wife and three of his four children? That I'd come to Texas to prevent an assassination and change the course of history? That I knew I could do that because I came from a future where we could have been IMing this conversation via computer?
Sadie, this is going to work out. I promise you that.
Again she said,
fine.
Then she said, I'll see you tomorrow, George, in school, and hung up very gently and politely. I held the telephone in my hand for several seconds, staring straight ahead at nothing. A rattling began on the windows facing my backyard. The rain had turned to sleet, after all.
Chapter 16. Coach Borman's Christmas Eve bash was a bust, and the ghost of Vince Knowles wasn't the only reason. On the 21st, Bobby Jill Allnut got tired of looking at that red slash running all the way down the left side of her face to the jawline and took a bunch of her mother's sleeping pills. She didn't die, but she spent two nights in Parkland Memorial, the hospital where both the president and the president's assassin would expire, unless I changed things. There are probably closer hospitals in 2011, almost certainly in Killeen, maybe even in Roundhill, but not during my 1 year of full-time teaching at DCHS. Dinner at the Saddle wasn't so hot either. The place was packed and convivial with pre-Christmas cheer, but Sadie refused dessert and asked to go home early. She said she had a headache. I didn't believe her. The New Year's Eve dance at Bountiful Grange No. 7 was a little better. There was a band from Austin called the Jokers, and they were really laying it down. Sadie and I danced beneath sagging nets filled with balloons until our feet were sore. At midnight, the Jokers swung into a venture-style version of Auld Lang Syne, and the band's lead man shouted, "May all your dreams come true in 1962. The balloons drifted down around us. I kissed Sadie and wished her a happy new year as we waltzed, but although she had been gay and laughing all evening, I felt no smile on her lips. And a happy new year to you, George. Could I have a glass of punch? I'm very thirsty. There was a long line at the spiked punch bowl, a shorter one at the unspiked version. I ladled the mixture of pink lemonade and ginger ale into a Dixie cup, but when I brought it back to where she had been standing, Sadie was gone.
Think she went out for some air, champ, Carl Jacoby said.
He was one of the high school's four shop teachers and probably the best, but I wouldn't have let him within 200 yards of a power tool that night. I checked the smokers clustered under the fire escape. Sadie wasn't among them. I walked to the sunliner. She was sitting in the passenger seat with her voluminous skirts billowing all the way up to the dashboard. God knows how many petticoats she was wearing. She was smoking and crying. I got in and tried to take her in my arms.
Sadie, what is it? What is it, hon?
As if I didn't know. As if I hadn't known for some time.
Nothing. Crying harder. I've got my period, that's all. Take me home.
It was only 3 miles, but that seemed like a very long drive. We didn't talk. I turned into her driveway and cut the motor. She'd stopped crying,
but she still didn't say anything.
Neither did I.
Some silences can be comfortable. This one felt deadly. She took her Winstons out of her handbag, looked at them, and put them back. The snick of the catch was very loud. She looked at me. Her hair was a dark cloud surrounding the white oval of her face. "Is there anything you want to tell me, George?" What I wanted to tell her, more than anything, was that my name wasn't George. I had come to dislike that name, almost to hate it. "Two things. The first is that I love you. The second is that I'm not doing anything I'm ashamed of. Oh, and 2A, nothing you'd be ashamed of." "Good. That's good. And I love you, George, but I'm going to tell you something if you'll listen." "I'll always listen." But she was scaring me. "Everything can stay the same for now. While I'm still married to John Clayton, even if it's just on paper and was never properly consummated in the first place, there are things I don't feel I have the right to ask you, or of you."
"Sadie."
She put her fingers to my lips. "For now. But I won't ever allow another man to put a broom in the bed. Do you understand me?" She put a quick kiss where her fingers had been, then dashed up the walk to her door, fumbling for her key. That was how 1962 started for the man who called himself George Amberson. New Year's Day dawned cold and clear, with the forecaster on the morning farm report threatening freezing mist in the lowlands. I had stowed the two bugged lamps in my garage. I put one of them in my car and drove to Fort Worth. I thought if there was ever a day when the raggedy-ass carnival on Mercedes Street would be shut down, it was this one. I was right. It was as silent as, well, as silent as the Tracker Mausoleum when I dragged Frank Dunning's body into it. Overturned trikes and a few toys lay in balding front yards. Some party boy had left a larger toy, a monstrous old Mercury, parked beside his porch. The car doors were still open. There were a few sad, leftover crepe streamers on the unpaved hardpan of the street and a lot of beer cans, mostly Lone Star, in the gutters. I glanced around at 2706 and saw no one looking out the large front window, but Ivy had been right. Anyone standing there would have a perfect line of sight into the living room of 2703. I parked on the concrete strips that passed for a driveway, as if I had every right to be at the former home of the unlucky Templeton family. I got my lamp and a brand new toolbox and went to the front door. I had a bad moment when the key refused to work, but it was just new. When I wetted it with some saliva and jiggled it a little, it turned, and I went in. There were four rooms, if you counted the bathroom, visible through a door that hung open on one working hinge. The biggest was a combined living room and kitchen. The other two were bedrooms. In the larger one, there was no mattress on the bed. I remembered Ivy saying, "Be like taking your dog on vacation, won't it?" In the smaller one, Rosette had drawn Crayola girls on walls where the plaster was decaying and the lathing showed through. They were all wearing green jumpers and big black shoes. They had out-of-proportion pigtails as long as their legs, and many were kicking soccer balls. One had a Miss America tiara perched on her hair and a big old red lipstick smile. The house still smelled faintly of whatever fried meat Ivy had cooked for their final meal before going back to Moselle to live with her mama, her little hellion, and her broke-back husband. This was where Lee and Marina would begin the American phase of their marriage. They'd make love in the bigger of the two bedrooms, and he would beat her there. It was where Lee would lie awake after long days, putting together storm doors and wondering why the hell he wasn't famous. Hadn't he tried? Hadn't he tried hard? And in the living room, with its hilly up-and-down floor and its threadbare bile-green carpet, Lee would first meet the man I wasn't supposed to trust, the one that accounted for most, if not all, of the doubts Al had held on to about Oswald's role as the lone gunman. That man's name was George de Morenschildt, and I wanted very much to hear what he and Oswald had to say to each other. There was an old bureau on the side of the main room that was closest to the kitchen. The drawers were a jumble of mismatched silverware and crappy cooking utensils. I pulled the bureau away from the wall and saw an electrical socket. Excellent. I put the lamp on top of the bureau and plugged it in. I knew someone might live here a while before the Oswalds moved in, but I didn't think anyone would be apt to take the leaning lamp of Pisa when they decamped. If they did, I had a backup unit in my garage. I drilled a hole through the wall to the outside with my smallest bit, pushed the bureau back into place, and tried the lamp. It worked fine. I packed up and left the house, being careful to lock the door behind me. Then I drove back to Jody. Sadie called and asked me if I would like to come over and have some supper. Just cold cuts, she said, but there was pound cake for dessert if I cared for some. I went over. The dessert was as wonderful as ever, but things weren't the same, because she was right, there was a broom in the bed. Like the Jimla Rosette had seen in the back of my car, it was invisible, but it was there. Invisible or not, it cast a shadow. Sometimes a man and a woman reach a crossroads and linger there, reluctant to take either way, knowing the wrong choice will mean the end, and knowing there's so much worth saving. That's the way it was with Sadie and me during that unrelenting gray winter of 1962. We still went out to dinner once or twice a week, and we still went to the Candlewood bungalows on the occasional Saturday night. Sadie enjoyed sex, and that was one of the things that kept us together. On three occasions, we shapped hops together. Donald Bellingham was always the DJ, and sooner or later, we'd be asked to reprise our first Lindy Hop. Kids always clapped and whistled when we did, not out of politeness either. They were authentically wowed, and some of them started to learn the moves themselves. Were we pleased? Sure, because imitation really is the most sincere form of flattery, but we were never as good as that first time, never so intuitively smooth. Sadie's grace wavered. Once she missed her grip on a flyaway and would have gone sprawling if there hadn't been a couple of husky football players with quick reflexes standing nearby. She laughed it off, but I could see the embarrassment on her face and the reproach, as if it had been my fault. Which in a way it was. There was bound to be a blow-up. It would have come sooner than it did if not for the Jody Jamboree. That was our greening, a chance to linger a little and think things over before we were forced into a decision neither of us wanted to make. Ellen Dougherty came to me in February and asked me two things. First, would I please reconsider and sign a contract for the 62-63 school year? And second, would I please direct the junior-senior play again, since last year's had been such a smash hit? I refused both requests, not without a tug of pain. If it's your book, you'd have all summer to work on it, she coaxed. It wouldn't be long enough, I said, although at that point I didn't give shit one about the murder place. Sadie Dunhill says she doesn't believe you care a fig for that novel. It was an insight she hadn't shared with me. It shook me, but I tried not to show it. Sadie doesn't know everything. The play, then? At least do the play. As long as it doesn't involve nudity, I'll back anything you choose. Given the current composition of the school board and the fact that I myself only have a 2-year contract as principal, that's a mighty big promise. You can dedicate it to Vince Knowles, if you like. Vince has already had a football season dedicated to his memory, Ellie. I think that's enough. She went away, beaten. The second request came from Mike Coslaw, who would be graduating in June, and told me he intended to declare a theater major at college.
But I'd really like to do one more play here, with you, Mr. Amberson, because you showed me the way.
Unlike Ellie Dougherty, he accepted the excuse about my bogus novel without question, which made me feel bad. Terrible, really. for a man who didn't like to lie, who had seen his marriage collapse because of all the ones he'd heard from his I-can-stop-whenever-I-want wife. I was certainly telling a passel of them, as we said in my Jody days. I walked Mike out to the student parking lot where his prized possession was parked, an old Buick sedan with fender skirts, and asked him how his arm felt now that the cast was off. He said it was fine, and he was sure he'd be set for football practice this coming summer. Although, he said, if I got cut, it wouldn't break my heart. Then maybe I could do some community theater as well as school stuff. I want to learn everything. Set design, lighting, even costumes. He laughed. People will start calling me queer. Concentrate on football, making grades, and not getting too homesick the first semester, I said. Please, don't screw around. He did a zombie Frankenstein voice.
Yes, master.
How's Bobby Jill?
Better, he said. There she is.
Bobby Jill was waiting by Mike's Buick. She waved at him, then saw me, and immediately turned away as if interested in the empty football field and the rangeland beyond. It was a gesture everyone in the school had gotten used to. The scar from the accident had healed to a fat red string. She tried to cover it with cosmetics, which only made it more noticeable. Mike said,
I tell her to quit with the powder already. It makes her look like a advertisement for Sums Mortuary, but she won't listen. I also tell her I'm not going with her out of pity, or so she won't swallow any more pills. She says she believes me, and maybe she does, on sunny days.
I watched him hurry to Bobby Jill, grab her by the waist and swing her around. I sighed, feeling a little stupid and a lot stubborn. Part of me wanted to do the damn play. Even if it was good for nothing else, it would fill the time while I was waiting for my own show to start. But I didn't want to get hooked into the life of Jody in more ways than I already was. Like any possible long-term future with Sadie, my relationship with the town needed to be on hold. If everything went just right, it was possible I could wind up with the girl, the gold watch, and everything. But I couldn't count on that. No matter how carefully I planned, even if I succeeded, I might have to run, and if I didn't get away, there was a good chance that my good deed on behalf of the world would be rewarded by life in prison or the electric chair in Huntsville. It was Deke Simmons who finally trapped me into saying yes. He did it by telling me I'd be nuts to even consider it. I should have recognized that as,
Old Brer Fox, please don't throw me in that briar patch,
shtick. But he was very sly about it, very subtle. A regular Brer Rabbit, you might say. We were in my living room drinking coffee on a Saturday afternoon while some old movie played on my snow-fuzzy TV, Cowboys in Fort Hollywood, standing off 2,000 or so attacking Indians. Outside, more rain was falling. There must have been at least a few sunny days during the winter of 62, but I can't recall any. All I can remember are cold fingers of drizzle always finding their way to the barbered nape of my neck in spite of the turned-up collar of the sheepskin jacket I'd bought to replace the ranch coat.
You don't want to worry about that damn play just because Ellen Dougherty's got her underwear all in a bunch about it, Deke said. Finish your book. Get a bestseller and never look back. Live the good life in New York. Have a drink with Norman Mailer and Irwin Shaw at the White Horse Tavern.
Uh-huh, I said. John Wayne was blowing a bugle. I don't think Norman Mailer has to worry too much about me. Irwin Shaw either.
Also, you had such a success with Of Mice and Men, he said. Anything you did as a follow-up would probably be a disappointment by compare. Oh, geez, look at that. John Wayne just got an arrow through his hat. Lucky it was the 20-gallon deluxe.
I was more miffed by the idea that my second effort might fall short than I should have been. It made me think about how Sadie and I couldn't quite equal our first performance on the dance floor, despite our best efforts. Deke seemed completely absorbed in the TV as he said,
Besides, Ratty Sylvester has expressed an interest in the junior-senior. He's talking about arsenic and old lace. Says he and the wife saw it in Dallas 2 years ago, and it was a regular old knee-slapper.
Good God, that chestnut? And Fred Sylvester of the science department as director? I wasn't sure I'd trust Ratty to direct a grammar school fire drill. If a talented but still very damp around the edges actor like Mike Coslaw ended up with Ratty at the helm, it could set his maturing process back 5 years. Ratty and arsenic and old lace? Jesus wept.
There wouldn't be time to put on anything really good anyway, Deke went on. So I say let Ratty take the fall. I never liked the scurrying little sumbitch anyway. Nobody really liked him, so far as I could tell, except maybe for Mrs. Ratty, who scurried by his side to every school and faculty function wrapped in acres of organdy. But he wouldn't be the one to take the fall. That would be the kids.
They could put on a variety show, I said. There'd be time enough for that.
Oh, Christ, George, Wallace Beery just took an arrow in the shoulder. I think he's a goner.
Deke?
No, John Wayne's dragging him to safety. This old shoot-'em-up doesn't make a lick of sense, but I love it, don't you?
Did you hear what I said? A commercial came on. Keenan Wynn climbed down off a bulldozer, doffed his hard hat, and told the world he'd walk a mile for a camel. Deke turned to me.
No, I must have missed it.
Sly old fox, as if. I said there'd be time to put on a variety show. A review. Songs, dances, jokes, and a bunch of sketches.
Everything but girls doing the hoochie-coo? Or were you thinking of that, too?
Don't be a dope.
So that makes it vaudeville. I always liked vaudeville.
Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are, and all that.
He dragged his pipe out of the pocket of his cardigan, stuffed it with Prince Albert, and fired it up.
You know, we actually used to do something like that down to the Grange. The show was called Jody Jamboree, but not since the late 40s, though. Folks got a little embarrassed by it, although no one ever came right out and said so. And vaudeville wasn't what we called it.
What are you talking about?
It was a minstrel show, George. All the cowboys and farmhands joined in. They wore blackface, sang and danced, told jokes in what they imagined was a Negro dialect, and more or less based on Amos and Andy.
I began to laugh.
Did anyone play the banjo?
As a matter of fact, on a couple of occasions our current principal did.
Ellen played the banjo in a minstrel show?
Careful. You're starting to speak in iambic pentameter. That can lead to delusions of grandeur, pard.
I leaned forward.
Tell me one of the jokes.
Dick cleared his throat and began speaking in two deep voices.
Say there, Brother Tambo, what did you buy that jar of Vaseline for? Well, I believes it was 49 cents.
He looked at me expectantly, and I realized that had been the punchline. Did they laugh? I almost feared the answer.
Split their guts and hollered for more. You heard those jokes around the square for weeks after.
He looked at me solemnly, but his eyes were twinkling like Christmas lights. We're a small town. Our needs when it comes to humor are quite humble. Our idea of Rabelaisian wit is a blind feller slipping on a banana peel.
I sat thinking. The Western came back on, but Deke seemed to have lost interest in it. He was watching me.
That stuff could still work, I said.
George, that stuff always does.
It wouldn't need to be funny black fellers, either.
Couldn't do it that way anymore, anyway, he said. Maybe in Louisiana or Alabama, but not on the way to Austin, which the folks at the Slimes Herald call Com Simp City. And you wouldn't want to, would you?
No. Call me a bleeding heart, but I find the idea repulsive.
And why bother? Corny jokes.
Boys in big old suits with padded shoulders instead of cornpone overalls. Girls in knee-high flapper dresses with lots of fringes. I'd love to see what Mike Coslaw could do with a comedy skit.
Oh, he'd kill it, Deke said, as if that were a foregone conclusion. Pretty good idea.
Too bad you don't have time to try it out.
I started to say something.